Wednesday, August 11th, energy committee meeting. And I just wanted to introduce Michael Nardello, who's joining us for the first time today.
Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Diane. Good to be here. Glad you're on the board as well. I thought you two might know each other. We do. We know each other pretty well.
Just a little.
The occasional party, perhaps?
Probably a bit more than that. More than occasional.
All right. Well, we can get started. I didn't get any, there's no public participation right now, and I didn't get any comments or anything. So we can move on to Chris. If you're already sharing your screen, you can get rolling on the 6:30 numbers.
Okay, well, great. Good to see folks. I hope you're all enjoying your summers, surviving the heat. I think we can be pretty quick, excuse me, to the bunch tonight and work our way through the collateral. I do note, when I look at the screen here, I'm almost embarrassed to say, when you look in the upper left-hand corner of the page and you see 188 pages, we are working feverishly to consolidate and condense down the collateral for meetings. So in the next couple of quarters, we're going to try to skinny this down. And nonetheless, we'll kind of hit the highlights this evening and get you on your way.
We normally get this done before midnight.
Yeah, come on, Sergio. Yeah, I got that. So I'm just going to scroll through here for everyone. And again, stop me along the way, but we'll hit just the highlights. Quick updates. I don't know if folks have made themselves or provided themselves access to some of this information, but if you're on our website or if you'd like to see stuff, we're regularly producing collateral really across the different practices. So on the retirement plan, the E&F front, and the wealth office. So there's a ton of stuff being by research and others. And certainly would encourage you to look for that information again on the website. And if you have questions or whatnot, obviously track me down. We continue to grow, as you see there on the bottom half of the page, and trying to do that thoughtfully as the practice continues to grow. We want to obviously stay apace with that. You see there that we've added a number of folks over the course of the last several months, and I'll look to continue to do so. And obviously, that growth comes with a recognition that you folks, our existing clients, are most important, and we want to make sure we've got the resources and the coverage, obviously, to get you the level of service that you're accustomed to, but we do continue to grow. So just quick firm updates, and then on the governance front for the pension plans, this quarter is really the one you'll remember when we just pause and look quickly at the investment policy statements for the two pension plans and make sure that they're in good working order. So what we've done here for you, and there's some actuarial collateral here that we touch on in other quarters that we keep in the report, but we don't have to, absent any questions, spend time on that this evening. So the IPS, you see there, just in terms of a basic framework and things that we look for, for kind of an effective blueprint, if you will, in terms of the responsibilities that you folks have to provide perspective and help on administering the plans. We think that the IPSs for the two pension plans are in good working order and have all the necessary, you know, components, if you will, of an effective document. You see there in the lower left, right-hand corner, excuse me, no recommendations for the committee this evening in terms of alterations to the two policy statements for just purposes of sake of ease, I suppose. We do include the two IPSs. Michael would encourage you, if you think it makes sense, read through this at your you know, convenience, and if you've got any questions on it, but, you know, the other committee members are familiar with it. So I think it's in good working order. We don't have any suggestions again, and we just provided the two executed copies, so you've got them in hand. So really, the point of the governance calendar review this quarter is simply an affirmation back to the committee that we think that the documents are in good working order and don't require any alterations. Any questions or thoughts on the IPS front? I know it's kind of, the venue's kind of tough, right? Because I'm scrolling through this quickly, but I know we've reviewed these a couple of times in the past. So,
because I just noticed that you still have Phil Penn signing the IPS.
Is that so I suppose, Bill, we should probably have you sign and write just as a matter of protocol, if you think that makes sense.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's a good point, Serge. I'll make note of that. We'll send fresh copies over to Bill just to have it updated accordingly. Okay, so that was really it. There's a little bit more collateral in the governance section, but they're things that tend to relate more to corporate plans, ERISA plans. So we've just got to recast that here. As you folks well know, government plans technically aren't subject to ERISA, but a lot of folks like to kind of follow the spirit of it in terms of a municipal plan oversight and administration. And I think that these, again, on the right-hand side of the page are things I suspect are familiar with to many members of the committee, and I think generally as guideposts for things that we certainly look to adhere to for the town plans, again, even though technically they're not ERISA subject, if you will. And then more broadly on the governance front, things I think that are all things that the town is doing, right? Meeting regularly, having a committee to provide advice and contacts, and recording the meetings, as Bill just mentioned, running through governance considerations and topics, documenting all this activity, slide deck we've got up in front of us and some of the other collateral we share periodically. You folks are all doing that stuff, and I think from an oversight and governance perspective are in good working order. So those were the updates on the governance front. Any questions from folks before we transition over to a quick market update, and then we'll look at the portfolios? Does it look like anyone's got questions? So we'll forge ahead here. So certainly interesting times, right? We did our mid-year seminar, webinar rather, excuse me, an update about 2 weeks ago. And certainly interesting times, right? And we've continued to adhere to this idea and would welcome input from the committee that obviously the variant is of concern and something to be mindful of, but we think ultimately it's likely that we'll kind of grind our way through this, and this isn't the right term, but I'll use it nonetheless, some of this noise here, and that we still think when you look at the macroeconomic backdrop, it's a pretty solid one. You see in the upper right-hand corner of the page here, we've really recovered all of the output on the GDP front that we had lost at the onset of the pandemic for all the reasons we've talked about, right, multiple times now, be that the stimulus that continues to play out and is in place largely, and then gains on the vaccination front. So we're still, you know, modestly constructive on prospects for the markets over the course of the next couple of quarters. Lots of noise and discussion on the inflation front, right? And it is certainly in the lower left-hand corner, elevated a good deal from that very low inflation levels that we were running at pre-pandemic. Again, don't think that it ultimately rises to a level and sustains itself that would impede the recovery, again, that we think is underway. And there's lots of evidence that's underway, of course. I know you all know that. And kind of accepted this idea that the Fed has put out, right, that I think we all know and acknowledge that inflation is elevated for supply chain disruption reasons and the like, but things are recalibrating. And we likely run it as slightly north of what we had pre-pandemic level, but again, not one that ultimately proves problematic for the economy as things begin to, kind of recalibrate again. You've seen that even a little bit in the way of commodity price activity recently, when that started to dampen down a bit from those sharper levels in the spring. And then the other thing, we talked, I think, a little bit about this in our call in the spring, and it continued to an extent, at least when you look at the year-to-date numbers in the lower right-hand corner of the page, this idea, right, that we've had this broader pattern of asset class returns, and you know, some of those areas that had kind of struggled to gain a footing right out of the recovery, you know, April, May of 2020, when things started to come back, and then kind of the tech growth names and the glamour names, the pandemic resistant names were kind of leading the charge. Others were left behind, but more recently, as you see here in the lower right, things like small cap names in the US, things like value as a style, you know, kind of the reopening benefits for things like commodities and REITs are you know, more readily evident year to date. And I think as we mentioned on our call in May, that's encouraging to us, right? Because we think that historically, not we think, we know historically, those broader asset class returns have often foreshadowed continuing gains on the macroeconomic front. So we still think we're, you know, it's kind of interesting, maybe mid-cycle in terms of the recovery on a global scale. We kind of have this interesting dynamic, right, where, you know, there's this notion that China maybe peaked last fall. The U.S. here, we maybe had the peak in terms of the pace of the recovery centering around the second quarter data, and the hope and expectation that some of that momentum on a relative basis shifts to Europe in the coming quarters. But yet, when you bring everything together on a global basis, we still think that, again, you know, there's room for more economic recovery, and that should, you know, follow suit with okay returns in the capital markets. So that is, that's the big picture backdrop macroeconomically, those three themes, excuse me, in the upper left-hand corner.
Chris, do you, does the firm have a perspective in terms of international equities versus domestic right now? I presume that international is underperformed the S&P 500 and a lot of the U.S. indexes. But going forward, do they think that there's relative value internationally, or still stick domestically?
No, I think Sergio, we are. I don't think we included valuations this quarter. Let me see. I could be wrong on that, just to help frame a better response. Fixed income. Oh, we did. So upper left-hand corner of the page here, right, just in terms of where we stand. So U.S. equities have done better, right, as we all know. But valuations, to an extent, reflect that. You know, relative valuations are a bit higher and a bit more astray from kind of those running averages, if you will, U.S. versus where they stand on the international and emerging market front. So we are kind of, you know, cautiously constructive on Europe and emerging markets. And one of the reasons is obviously this valuation relationship. You know, the other is this idea, again, right, that under the hood, you know, Europe probably, the Eurozone might have a bit more on the stimulus front to play out here and kind of catch up with what's going on in the U.S. and elsewhere. And then moreover, when you look at the constitution of international equity markets, they tend to be more oriented to those areas that had lags. So if you look in the upper left-hand corner here, right, I know this is the U.S. market, but overseas, you know, there's meaningful exposure to some of the cyclicals, things like financials and some of the consumer and industrial names and things that tend to do well in periods of, you know, a momentum in terms of the economic backdrop and profile. So kind of long-winded, but I think when you put valuations together with stimulus potential alongside just the constitution of international markets, you know, we kind of like the prospects overseas and have continued to advocate that as clients keep meaningful exposure there. And I know that's less of an issue for the town because you folks have always kind of been disciplined with that and done that. So, yeah, I think the short answer is we do think that there's some interesting things going on overseas and some decent potential there as well. Is that enough, Sergio, or not enough, or too much? Or
Actually, I wouldn't mind seeing the bottom graph that you have on that page. It looks like it's
Yeah, sure.
That's right.
Yep, so this is, I'm just gonna change my screen here. So here's the big thing internationally, we kind of hint at it here, right, is we obviously have had the Chinese authorities kind of change their stance, starting with, you know, this, what is it, for-profit school kind of area of the markets, and perhaps extending into other tech areas where they've kind of put the clamps on some of this stuff. So it's been a little bit of a struggle there versus other areas of the market. When you talk to a lot of the international managers, and yours included, right, most of them underwrite to that market with an expectation that the political risk and response in China is elevated from where it is elsewhere, right, because they will play a heavy hand occasionally. But this is just the representation across, largest economies and where returns have been for the quarter, 2Q, and then the bars, obviously, year to date. So you do see, right, when you kind of peel back a little bit internationally, France, Canada, India, and Germany, and Italy, for that matter, right, with pretty solid and competitive returns vis-a-vis the U.S. So that, let me just see here. I skipped ahead, but I do want to keep us on task here. And as you all know, we do put an awful lot of detail and collateral in here. You know, I guess the other thing, just from a broader standpoint, right? So we've got elevated valuations for equities, but not dramatically so. The other big thing, right, is obviously interest rates remain, you know, all things considered, pretty darn low, right? I think the 10-year today finished at 133 or something like that. We've shown you information in the past. You'll remember when you correlate 10-year yields to returns for the aggregate bond index, which is a good proxy, you'll remember, for U.S. bond investing. The linkage there is pretty tight. It does give us kind of a framework going forward, right, of the return potential for fixed income. Spreads are tight as well, as you see here on the bottom of the lower right-hand corner of the page. Low base rates, tight spreads. You know, going forward, the prospects for fixed income returns are probably, you know, our frame of reference and our expectation should be are probably pretty modest. So just something when we look at the portfolios in a minute, we look at performance to be mindful of, right? And we've all known that because we've talked about it a million times, but talk a little bit about equity, we talk a little bit about fixed, you know, on the real asset front, I think, as we mentioned earlier, right, they're pretty healthy gains here as well, just kind of decomposing in the left-hand side of the page here, some of the component parts across the commodity spectrum, and obviously energy's had a particularly strong run. And then kind of the reopening bid for REITs, you see on the right-hand side of the page, and some pretty decent really returns, you know, across the entirety of the asset class, if you will. So, pretty robust backdrop for returns here. You know what, I skipped it, but let's just go back for, I promise, 10 seconds, and then we'll look at the portfolio details. Just here, just to give you in kind of a consolidated fashion, left to right, fixed income, international equity, the real assets, just where we are quarter and year to date on the return front. And I think, as you all know, right here, U.S. bonds, we've got off to a rough start with a meaningfully higher, a pretty decent spike in rates, you remember, earlier in the year. And those rates have since come back in a bit and had a decent quarter, but still playing catch-up calendar year-to-date for broad fixed income. And then those good returns we talked about on the equity front earlier and moreover replicated to an extent and even outpacing in the real asset categories of the market. So as we'll see in a minute when we look at the numbers, the one-year numbers continue to be pretty robust, all things considered. I think in the interest of time, if no one objects, let me pause there for just a minute and see if folks had any questions just on the market backdrop or macroeconomically or other stuff going on with the economy before we segue over to the portfolios?
Chris, do you still have the slide that shows where your firm thinks the relative value is for, you know, equities versus bonds, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so Sergio, we don't have it here. We took it down because we're reworking the framework a little bit. So we used to call it the bubble chart, right, where we looked at equity versus fixed and value. So it's not in this report because we've taken it down. Our research team is reworking that framework a little bit. So we'll have something to share with you in a quarter or two's time that is similar to that. I guess I would say just more broadly, equity versus fixed, right? I think if you mix everything together, you would still think, even with elevated valuations, given how low rates are, that, you know, we still tilt equity in favor of equity versus fixed. The international markets, we talked about having some interesting opportunity vis-a-vis the U.S. markets on the valuation front and for those other factors. So I think the portfolio kind of continues to stand in terms of its allocation in a manner that's largely aligned with our best thinking. And our guidepost, as you all know, again, right, is what we're trying to achieve actuarially from a return standpoint. So if that helps at all, Sergio, I think my statement to the committee would be, I think that the portfolios are in pretty good working order and aligned with our thinking. And again, we'll have something more explicit for you to look at in coming quarters, but we are reworking that optic.
So your firm and you are comfortable with the 4.2% underweight to fixed income?
So that's a good point. So we're comfortable with a bit of an underweight to fixed income. I will tell you that, and it's a good reminder, we did Bill made contributions to the town plan just recently, and you can all guess where all that money went. It went to fixed income, right? But just shore up that underweight a little bit.
Okay.
And then we left a little bit of liquidity for pension payments over the next couple of months. So good question, Sergio, and a good anticipation. Portfolio has been rescaled back closer to target by virtue of the recent contribution.
Okay.
But it's still it's still nominally overweight equity, which we're entirely comfortable with.
Yeah, you know, I just gotta chime in. I continue to, you know, whenever, and I know I was out the last couple of meetings, but I still continue to question the international equity exposure. I know we've talked about this before, but, you know, just, you know, how long does it take for other economies to really come up against powerful economies, especially coming out of the pandemic? And I also think there's just so much international business out through U.S. equity. You know, it's, you know, 34% versus 22%. And our equity side, you know, outside the REITs. So I continue to question that. I know it's in the IPS, so I think it's high. And I know it's in line with other municipalities.
Yep. No, listen, it's a fair question, Andrew. I don't know that there's ultimately a right answer, right? We all know what the constitution of the global equity market looks like, right? It's about 55 US, 45 international. This portfolio on the numbers is skewed a little bit more home country US. I think if I did the math right, we're about 60-40 US versus international. So we do have a bit of a US bias on versus the construct of the larger global equity market. We're comfortable with it, but I completely understand, you know, some of the reticence just around the size of it. We have clients that a lot of them that adhere to that global, you know, equity framework, 55-45. We have others, and a lot of them that are biased, like Canton is, right? We're a little bit more U.S. than what the construct calls for. And I would, you know, confess or admit that we do have a handful of clients where the sentiment is strong enough where they do have, you know, something like 2/3, 1/3 U.S. international, for example, and just skew a little bit more. you know, in a situation like this, that might be, you know, 20% international equity with the residual going to U.S., for example. I do think you'd want to keep it, you know, about 20% anyways, just from a diversification potential perspective. But completely accept your comments, Dan, and understand it. So again, there's not a right answer here, I don't think. And a lot of it comes from committee sentiment, and then Bill, ultimately, what you're comfortable with from a portfolio construction standpoint. We don't have issues with it as it exists, but I know that there's perfectly valid alternative opinions on it.
Great.
I don't know, Bill, if you want to think about that a little bit, you and I could reinvestigate it if you'd like.
Yeah, maybe we could look into it a little more, you and I, and maybe we'll report back.
It could be a source of funding down the road when we have to, you know, fund some payout.
Yeah, and then we've done that there in the past, too. You're right.
Right.
From international when we've needed liquidity for pension payments, and that's certainly something we could reinstitute.
Okay.
So let's the town plan. Here's performance. So an inline quarter. You see 5.1. I'm in the middle of the page for the plan. Net of manager fees. Calendar year to date up 7.4 versus 6.9. And then you see the 1 year number 27% for the 1 year period ending in June. So pretty decent fiscal year with the benchmark up a little less than 23%. So certainly a kind of a decent couple of quarters here rolling off, and you know, the longer dated numbers generally hold up pretty well versus benchmark also. So I think the story on the performance front is a constructive one. I won't go through all of them, but if you decompose a little bit at the individual mandate level, you know, we've done this in the past, as you remember. Again, I'll focus on the third column in, if no one objects. Those again are the fiscal year numbers. And you do see kind of additive and accretive results from all three of the fixed managers in kind of a choppy environment, right? You know, some spread gapping, and then spreads come in, and then rates go out, and then rates come in. And, you know, all three of your managers did a pretty good job navigating that. MetWest is the most conservative of this three, for sure. And probably most benchmark-like, and they certainly outpaced at a decent level versus the benchmark. The peer number's not quite as strong, but again, given the way they invest, it's not concerning to us. Numis and BlackRock, right, a little more ambitious with their convictions and looking different, you know, than their opportunity sets, and both of them have paid off pretty handsomely, as you see, up, you know, well north of what the bond fixed markets did over the last year, which is encouraging. The domestic equity index manager is kind of right in line. Not a great relative year for Earnest, which is the sub-advisor for your Harbor strategy. You see they were up 51%, which in a vacuum is great, right? Certainly no issues there. They did lag that value, small value benchmark a little bit. Some selection in tech and communications, it hurt them and held them back a little bit. I still think you see there, since you put them into the program, what is it, the fall of 18 over in the right here, even with that relative shortfall near term, you're still kind of holding serve here versus the benchmark and peers. And we don't show it on this page, but if you were to look at their 5-, 7-, and 10-year numbers versus benchmark and peer, they're still very strong. So I think that strategy will be just fine, and we fully recognize there's a little bit of a near-term shortfall, but nothing that quells up to it, you know, considering an action there for sure. Emerald up 48, you see there for the year, a touch behind benchmark. Healthcare and financial selection hurt them a little bit in the last two quarters. Again, we're not particularly concerned longer term. They're again holding serve since you brought them into the program. Both of those managers have disciplines that'll kind of take them away from the momentum segments of their respective markets, right? We've had a good deal of that in the reamp, in the small cap arena, and they shy away from some of that. So I think they are being consistent with their disciplines, and again, their longer term track records are intact, the teams are intact, and I think both will be just fine. And then international, pretty decent numbers as well, all things considered. So Europac, you know, ran off, you see here, and kind of our anchor, longer standing international manager, ran off a perfectly fine year. And then Oakmark came roaring back in a big way. You'll remember they got off to a little bit of a choppy start when we first brought them into the program, but they've had certainly a strong run of it over the last year and are doing great work. And the Invesco emerging market team, I think, will be fine as well. You see there, they stabilized a bit in the quarter and their longer dated numbers are competitive. Again, a touch behind for the 1 year, but not problematic. And Cohen doing some pretty good work in the REIT space. So, you know, we talked about, you know, a couple of hundred basis points of incremental return at the composite level. And I think what we're encouraged by, right, is the sources of that incremental return is spread across different segments of the portfolio, which is always encouraging. So I think we're in pretty good working order on the returns and performance. Any questions from the committee on any of that? I think we'd all sign up for 27% a year for sure, wouldn't we, every year? It'd be nice if we could do that year over year. And do that for 3 or 4 more years, and you can close these things, Bill, and, up and done with it. No, don't worry about it anymore. So what I might skip ahead here quickly, it doesn't look like folks have questions. Again, I apologize. We've got all the collateral jammed in here, but just so you see it, for Mike, for your edification, the firefighter plan in town shares essentially the same allocation and manager lineup that the town plan has. So the numbers here and this detail looks very familiar, should look very familiar by design. Same thing, Sergio, to your question, Bill had a smaller contribution here that all went to fixed income to shore up that deficit on fixed a little bit. Otherwise, the allocation is in kind of, you know, working order and consistent with our best thinking. And the numbers here, you know, the cash flow profile is a touch different, so they're not identical, but they're certainly very close, right? So 27% return from the volunteer plan over the last year, and you know, generally a kind of longer term holding up decently versus the benchmark as well. So,
hey, Chris?
Yes.
Question. Are any of your clients that is public plans asking questions about crypto? And what's your firm's view?
Yeah, oh boy, it's a great question, Sergio. We haven't had that dialogue as much in the municipal arena. We've gotten it a lot. I know our wealth advisors are getting it a lot with personal clients and our endowment and foundation clients as well. And consultants are getting some of that chatter. I can send, if no one objects, we've done some work in the space. I think we've generally been pretty gun-shy, Sergio, quite frankly, as kind of some of these trading protocols and just the dynamics of the market are still very much in flux, we think. So we have certainly not advocated for dedicated crypto anywhere. To the extent that you can begin to implement, and you can in an institutional setting now, that's starting to come to pass, but we've been kind of gun-shy about it for all the reasons you've read about. Happy to share more collateral with you. We've written a couple of white papers on it and have kind of put those out on our website and elsewhere if people would like to see that information. Happy to share it, but we haven't had any municipal clients for sure do any type of actual, you know, dollars to work in the space yet.
Okay.
I think everyone's kind of waiting to see that if that, you know, marketplace, if you call it that, matures and begins to institutionalize a little bit more before they'd be comfortable doing that. And that's our opinion as well. What are people hearing differently on the committee or other thoughts around that?
I haven't heard. Just what you hear on CNBC, but I'm not surprised that in terms of public pension plans that there's not really a lot of movement or interest in it yet. I'm intrigued by the fact that there's probably a, you know, 1.8 trillion in crypto assets. So it's not irrelevant. My guess is it's not going away, but I would tend to agree it's too early to get into something that volatile. But certainly interesting to track it and see where it goes.
Yeah, and that's our kind of general viewpoint as well.
I think there's more around the software and also the servicing it. You know, like there's Coinbase Global just went public, and that's basically just providing a marketplace to trade the currencies, and the stock's just, you know, done great. So I don't know that it's the actual currencies, but everything around the currencies is certainly creating wealth, whether it be the market, the software, or, you know, like the market providers. So, and, you know, we've had some venture deals that came through that, you know, have created a lot of wealth, and it's not around the currency as much as it is around the services around it. So,
yeah, a lot of the infrastructure, like you said, Peter, is
exactly,
you know, coming to pass right now versus the actual crypto itself. If there are no other questions for folks, I think, Bill, that's all we had on pension plans, and then we can spend a minute or two on OPEB, and I know we wanted to talk about the DC program as well for a few minutes. So if it doesn't look, if someone objects, just tell me, but I'm going to use Bill's handy-dandy here. Very nice bookmarking. So OPEB, we've talked about markets, right? I just produced it in total, Bill. I didn't know if you wanted to share this with the Board of Finance too, so we left some of this introductory information in, and if you wanted to give it to them and they had questions, that's why. I know that obviously the pension committee doesn't. We've talked about all this already, so I'm going to jump right to the chase here. Again, as everyone remembers, right, we kind of leveraged in here just the simple balance total return framework. We kind of leveraged our active fee budget into fixed income and international, and we're content as this plan begins to size up, just indexing all of the domestic equity, and don't have any recommendations for the committee in terms of changing that. I know Bill and I have been chatting a little bit about working with the actuary and ultimately having maybe a slightly different allocation with the benefit of some more current actuarial demographics. But for the time being, the plan, you know, looks like most of our OPEB trust, just a simple, call it 65-35 mix. And fortunately,
The interesting thing, and we probably have talked about this, but every quarter I kind of forget what we've talked about and what we haven't, but I find it interesting that this is actually more aggressively positioned towards equities versus fixed income, even though my recollection is that the funded ratio is actually higher for OPEB than it is for the DB plan. So I'm just kind of surprised that we wouldn't go the opposite way and have a higher allocation to fixed income versus equities.
So I think, Sergio, that is the consideration that's kind of in development, and I'll defer to Bill on this, right? But your intuition, I think, is accurate. I think we just got to kind of connect those dots in that information most currently from the actuary, and there is, I think, a consideration around this allocation ultimately being a bit more conservative. So I would share your sentiment there. I don't know, Bill, I know you and I have been looking to try to connect with the actuary and haven't done that just yet, but.
Yeah, we just transitioned that over to Hooker and Holcomb. So, Chris, we can, you know, get a call with them to discuss some of that.
Mm-hmm. And I would I would imagine the other, I think Bill and I are kind of in agreement, Sergio, with you as well, right? That if the funded status is what we think it may be, we probably want to lock this down a little bit and de-risk it, you know, on the margin anyways. So that's certainly a real world consideration for us too. It's something we'll keep you posted on. In the interim, the numbers have been, you know, certainly very solid for this program. So 29% return for the fiscal year, and pretty decent outcomes since the program was put in place by the town not too long ago. So, you know, in a vacuum for what it is currently, no concerns around the managers or performance. And just a quick update for the committee. I don't know if there was other thoughts or observations beyond Sergio, your point.
No,
which is well taken. Okay, good. And then I think that finally brings us to the DC program. I don't know, Bill, I'm going to defer to you. I don't know if you wanted to give an update on the any interactions you've had with the folks over there, and I'm happy to do the same from our perspective. As everyone knows, Empower bought Mass Mutual, so there's been an integration going on there, and we've been obviously keeping tabs on that. Can give you a little high level color, but I didn't know, Bill, if you had other things you wanted to mention at the outset here.
Yeah, just a little bit, but I was supposed to have a marketing piece put together specifically for this call, but it didn't get here in time. But I'll share that out once I get it. The implementation is in process as far as the transition to Empower. It's supposed to go into effect fully in the last quarter of this year. And then that's basically a transition to what's called an easy platform. It's supposed to be seamless for the participants. Ultimately, it will allow the participants to gain some help and guidance at a pretty high level as far as how this investment's performing versus that, which they don't currently have for MassMutual customer service. There is additional services that will actually be provided if they choose to, you know, sign up for that and be charged. And that's for, it's called a My Total Retirement. Which allows them to, you know, basically based off their age, you know, get that sort of information. So it is, there's potential there for, you know, additional services and quality of service for those folks that are investing. From my side, it's supposed to be fairly seamless. I just have yet to see it. It's been delayed. It's supposed to be in place actually in this month here in August, but it got pushed for another 3 months.
Yeah, so we've obviously heard the same. I think the deal closed in January of this year. I think, as everyone knows, Empower is a pretty aggressive consolidator. And they've got designs on challenging the behemoths. And I don't know if people read in the press, they just announced that they're buying a retirement practice from Prudential. So this is kind of a marching thing here with lots of things going on. We've seen in the past when they've done these roll-ins and consolidations that, to Bill's point, they've generally been handled pretty well, and there has not been a lot of a disruption for participants, and the service model and the support that Bill will get and our interactions with them as your consultant behind the scenes, they're pretty easy to work with, and they you know, do have a lot of capabilities and resources. So in our monitoring of you know, kind of this transition, similar to what Bill's done, kind of the same general viewpoints, right? And I think it will ultimately prove to be, all things considered, beneficial to participants, a bigger platform, more sophistication, more resources, and other things that, again, will accrue to the benefit of both the town and the end participants. So I know we had talked about, I think, Bill, right, we had talked about if there's an appetite for you in the town to do an RFP and test the marketplace. And we've done that a couple of times just as a perspective for the committee. We just finished one with Simsbury. Simsbury was in the exact same position you folks are in. They had a legacy Hartford platform that rolled into Mass Mutual. And we went out to market with them and helped them on that. They actually ended up ultimately choosing IMCA, but the Empower bid was very competitive. And happy to help you do that as well, and are doing that in a couple other towns also as we speak. So. That's always, we just want to make sure you're aware of it. That's always a resource and a capability that we can extend to the town if you're interested.
I was just wondering, with this transition, should I wait to see how this goes and see where we land, and then maybe we can discuss an RFP depending on the performance and our handling of it?
Yeah, we, it hasn't come all the way through. You know, one of the, for probably the 17th time, I'll mention it. I know you folks are sick of hearing it, right? We all know, right, that we've got, we're a little bit beholden to the platform in the sense that we've got the very ambitious crediting rate, right? 3%, I think, for the guaranteed fund. And that limits both from a cost response perspective, what MassMutual and now Empower likely are able to do. And there's been some limitation around the lineup and access to funds and strategies. I think that might loosen up a little bit on a going forward basis. But again, you all know that. We've talked about it a million times. I think we all understand that dynamic, and to an extent that still exists, and we'll continue to monitor. So with that, there is this quarter, I just noticed when I was prepping for the meeting last night and looking through the materials, this quarter there is a ton of governance stuff. I'm going to try to hit the highlights here for you folks, but there's a couple of different components of our governance review this quarter for DC plans. Just a reminder here, just in terms of plan design, right? A couple of things that come out of that. You folks, as you know, kind of do have a tiered mix in the sense that we do have target date funds, and we'll talk about those. We do have a bit of a core, a passive ability in the plan, and some actively managed and self-directed brokerage is probably beyond the needs of this plan. But nonetheless, you know, we do have a reasonably diversified lineup, and one that provides a lot of choice to participants. And alongside that, right, target date funds is the QDIA. There is this notion that we should be thoughtful and kind of analyzing that regularly and making sure we all understand it. So the next several pages hopefully intend to help us do that. What we've done on this plan, you'll see, is we catalog and show the different categories available to participants in your plan. Those are the red bars. And then more broadly, what we see across kind of a broad, an admittedly broad peer group, right? We're using this 200 to 1,000 participant peer group. So you do see that the plan's got lots of coverage across many of the main categories, right? There's a balanced option, there's active bonds, there's index equity, there's active international, there's stable value in the form of the guaranteed fund. We've got the target date funds, of course. The one thing here that may kind of come out to the committee of interest, some of these categories you see here, dedicated emerging market, dedicated international bond, sector fund, real estate, some of that comes out under the hood in terms of exposure when we look at the target date portfolio. So in a way, there's kind of a second order access to some of these areas that aren't directly available to participants. But I would leave with the committee with the notion, right, that there is coverage given some of our limitations, again, from the platform across most of the major segments of the markets for a participant to build, you know, really any type of program that they'd want to, and a pretty reasonably diverse one at that. So I think our coverages in terms of asset class are in decent working order.
Hey, Chris?
Yes, Diane.
Sorry to interrupt. On that slide, I noticed, you know, ESG is really small across the 401k plans. Bill, do you get a lot of questions about that, or you're not, there's really no appetite or interest at Ken and Chris, like across the board? I just thought that would be gaining more traction than what that's showing.
You know, those go directly to MassMutual. I don't even see that.
Okay.
Yeah, they, those questions don't come to me. The customer service center actually handles.
We have seen, Diane, a lot of chatter in the industry, right? It seems like the younger component of the workforce has lots of interest in having those options. The take on them has been very low. And moreover, like you suggest, right, as evidenced here, not a lot of participants are in the at least immediate future, adding them. So we actually added a little bit of a bit here to go through it all in detail, right? But there's a growing interest in it, but not a lot of changes. But I do think over time, we are going to start to see probably more in the way of, you know, dedicated ESG offerings being made available on platforms. And then I suspect as well, right, as the younger workforce begins to build balances, the take in those areas, those type of strategies is likely to increase as well. So certainly something we're mindful of and talking about, but not seeing a lot of action on just yet.
Okay.
And then the other big thing, as everyone knows, right, is retirement income, which is kind of another emerging trend in the sense now that the baby boomers, for example, have done their accumulation and now the industry is trying to figure out in an orderly fashion how people can begin to draw that money down. So this notion of retirement income is a hot one. Again, and like I mentioned, an emergent one, right? I don't think there are definitive right answers or trends here just yet, but you see, I think everyone's working furiously on what some of the alternatives may be, and we'll keep you focused on that as well as this continues to gain traction. But retirement income is probably something you've read and heard a lot about over the last couple of quarters. You know, the other thing we want to do, just in terms of governance, obviously, is make sure that we're comfortable with the target date suite, right? So just as a reminder, I know you all know this, but, you know, just as a reminder, right, as a basic framework, the glide path is something we spend a lot of time analyzing and looking at and thinking about, right? I think everyone kind of understands how that works, right? It's basically generally this default to more equities early on in employees' tenure, if you will, and then drawing that down over time as they begin to approach retirement. Among the things beyond just the glide path that we'll talk about and reaffirm momentarily, just some of the other guidance from the DOL around kind of what we should be looking at in terms of the target date suite, right? And we'll do this in just a minute, as I promised. So the allocations, the individual strategies, the fees associated with them. You're using non-proprietary funds, right? We're using the T. Rowe suite on the MassMutual platform and Power platform. And again, I think we're documenting through time all these analytics. So I think as a committee, right, the takeaway is, hey, we need to know what these target date funds are and how they work. And I do think that you're doing all that. And then just a final kind of big picture thing, this notion, right, of balancing longevity and market risk and trying to do that thoughtfully. And we think the T. Rowe suite actually does a fairly nice job of kind of balancing those two considerations, risk versus longevity. So that's just a high level backdrop. So as mentioned, right, we are using in the plan the T. Rowe suite, which has been around for quite some time, and they're one of the 3-4 largest target date suites in the marketplace today. They have a through retirement glide path mentality, right? And that means they tend to run with higher equity allocations than some of their peers. They're particularly focused on that notion of longevity, right? And making sure that the participants, when they can afford to do it early in their careers, are accumulating assets with more aggressive total return vehicles like equities. And that's the kind of the mentality that T. Rowe has. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you see the glide paths kind of to the left here, and these are actually the allocations, excuse me. But the point made that there is under the hood for participants, right, in a pretty tidy package, access to an awful lot of stuff. So we talked earlier, right, some, you know, a participant using one of these funds, you know, having some high dedicated high yield bond, having some emerging market equity, you know, emerging market bond, you know, some of these ancillary asset classes, commodities, for example, are things that T. Rowe's doing in one kind of tidy package. So I think they're really diversified and thoughtful allocations. T. Rowe is a through allocator, as I mentioned, right? So you see here, we're just showing you a representation of their equity weighting versus peers throughout the glide path. And they do run at the beginning here, right? Earlier in the cycle with more equity, then they start to kind of come back down a bit. And then actually after retirement, actually persist with a little bit more equity than some of their other larger competitors. But as we'll see in a minute, that served participants really well. So we don't have any issues with that. I'm going to set aside the risk return stuff. We can come back to it if need be. One other thing before we look at just performance and that stable value. So we've got the guaranteed fund, right? The old Hartford Legacy product backed by the general account, and don't have any issues with the MassMutual approach right now. And actually our analysts there spent a decent amount of time talking to them and the integration with Empower, and reasonably encouraged by their intentions around kind of keeping everything as is. So I think that the guaranteed fund, you've got that kind of contractual commitment to 3% right now, and that's not changing anytime soon. So I think we're in good working order there. So I apologize. That was a ton of content this quarter. Anything from the group just on governance trends more broadly before we spend just a minute or two on the lineup and performance? That's not always the most exciting collection of topics, I confess, but good to just touch base on those periodically, so we're kind of staying connected to the marketplace and what we're seeing out there. Doesn't look like, looking at the screen here, that anyone had any questions there. So just in terms of where we stand at the end of June, $16.7 million, you see in the lower left-hand corner of the page, of participant assets. Nothing when you look at the asset category level, as we would expect, right, that's trended all that significantly different in terms of utilization. Importantly and encouragingly, you know, two-thirds of the assets or thereabouts remain in those target date funds, which we think actually is a nice outcome for a lot of participants that don't want to have that responsibility of doing their own allocation work and selection up with the open menu, right, on the top half of the page. But there are some folks doing it. And you can see that there, that across those individual options, there are some folks who've chosen to work their mixes on their own. But just a nice ramp up, right? As you would expect, given what's going on in markets over the last year, we've gone from 13 million up to 16.8 million. So kind of mirroring that gain in value that we've seen elsewhere in the markets more broadly. So that is encouraging for sure. And then just switching gears quickly to performance. And again, right, I think as has been the case for quite some time, the net of fees, the performance for the target date suites, T-Gro has been pretty competitive, as you see there, versus peer offerings and kind of consistent top decile rankings, really across the entirety of the suite. So we don't have any concerns with performance for that suite, and we've got it on maintained, as you see there on the far right, from a due diligence perspective. No issues there. A couple of funds along the way here in the individual segment of the lineup that are, you know, have had a quarter or two of struggle. Again, nothing that really to us jumps up to be immediately and persistent or problematic. I think in most cases, the longer traded track records there, you know, are reasonably competitive. So I think we're in pretty good working order. And remember, we're kind of working this lineup against availability on the MassMutual platform. So, you know, the world is not necessarily our oyster here. We've got to kind of work with strategies that we can readily access there. But we've got the entirety of the lineup on maintain. And certainly our analysts are kind of working more curiously on a couple of those strategies where we've seen a performance issue for a quarter or two and are mindful of that, but nothing just yet that rises up to the level of action. So
Chris?
Yes, sir.
Maybe this is a question for Bill, but has Empower indicated that they'll be able to support all of the funds that are currently available in the DC plans?
They haven't indicated anything to me yet on that.
If I may, Bill, I think that's Sergio, their intention, right, is to not disrupt that. So I'm hoping ultimately there's a broader array of funds available once that integration is fully completed. But I think certainly what you've got access to, I don't think their intentions are to run afoul of that with client, you know, legacy Mass Mutual clients. So that's all I had on the DC plan for folks. I did want to keep us as best we could on schedule here. So I can, if there are no other questions, Bill, I can either you tell me what you want me to do. I can go to the minutes or I can see the screen to you, whatever you'd like to do.
Yeah, well, if you want to just flip to the minutes, Sergio, if we can get those approved, that'd be great.
Okay.
Let's see. Flips over there.
What
happened there?
That's my fault. Hit the wrong button.
There you go.
Okay. So I'm assuming everybody's had a chance to read these. I'll move to approve the minutes from the prior quarter end meeting.
I wasn't there. I can't second.
Peter?
Yeah, I was there. Oh, second. I don't remember being there.
Well, it was a while ago.
It was probably because the conversation was so scintillating, Peter. Well. Maybe.
Well, thank you, and I should be getting the material within the next week or two, and Sergio, that should clarify if there's going to be any issue at all with the same investments being made available.
Gotcha.
Does anybody have any questions or anything else to add? Besides Chris being right on the dot here with getting this done in an hour, that's fantastic. All right, well, thank you all. I appreciate your time. And we'll be seeing you in November.
Good.
All right.
Thanks, you guys.
Thank you all.
Good night.
Bye. Bye.